Paul Hamilton.
I'm a great fan of Radio 4 Extra, which of course some of you may remember used to be called Radio 7. I don't know why they changed the name. Something to do with branding, no doubt. Perhaps they found in an audience survey that Radio 7 was too specific a name and the number 7 was alienating certain sections of the C1 market, and so they made it less specific by just calling it Radio 4 Extra, you know, Radio 7 being exactly 3 more than Radio 4, whereas Radio 4 Extra could be 3 more, but it could be 58 more. It could be a million more. Oh, what's the point of trying to second guess how these idiots think?
Also featuring the BBC Radio New Comedy Award winner, Lucy Beaumont, and Chortle Best Newcomer nominee, Stuart Hudson. Sabotage is only here on 4 Extra on Saturday night at 10.
The digital station on radio, TV and online. BBC Radio 4 Extra.
Now, more letters to Monica. These were letters written by the poet Philip Larkin to his friend Monica Jones over 40 years, and they only came to light when she died and they were found in his house in Hull. This is the penultimate look at those letters.
August 3, 1955, Cottingham, East Yorkshire. My dear lonely rabbit, well, here I am, back. I ought just to bring you up to date. I went home on Saturday afternoon, 1:30 to Grantham. A lovely run, the scorched land misty with heat, like a kind of bloom of heat. And at every station, Goole, Doncaster, Retford, Newark, importunate wedding parties, gawky and vociferous, seeing off couples to London. I was at home Sunday, Monday and Tuesday, doing nothing but pore over a poem, play records and go walks with Mother. I must say home is where the records are. I should love to play you the pieces I have by Muddy Waters, a blind singer.
You know the gypsy woman told me.
Coming back, I felt low. I bought 1984 and reread it with pleasure, thinking how like Hull it all was. 19th of August. Dearest Bun, the heat, felt ghastly this morning, due no doubt to my old enemy tomato skins, but am improved tonight. Of course, it may have been reading Betjeman's review of Kingsley's That Uncertain Feeling. I'm surprised no one treats Kingsley as a master of words, of style, of syntax. That is where his main strength lies. I'm longing for my copy. What the New Statesman terms a brilliantly funny opening scene in a public library is, I am prepared to swear, taken from one of my Wellington letters. Really, I do find it irritating. Of course, I'm not in possession of the text, or of my own letter of 10 years ago, but I do dislike being used to open the show, to make them think, ah, this is going to be just as funny as the other one. I've gone back to the Archers again, now I have a wireless. They haven't changed much. 11th of January, 1956. Dearest Bun and Only, the Ponce of Hessel rang up today to say that nearly all the 300 Less Deceiveds are sold, and he's telegrammed for the other 400 to be bound. What will happen when the reviews really start, I don't know. I'm trying to write a poem on something we saw in Chichester. Can you guess what? 12th of February. Dearest, I'm absolutely sick of my tomb poem and thought I would send it you unfinished as a token for St. Valentine's Day. Not that it's in any sense a Valentine, but to give you something special from me on that day. It's complete except for the last verse, which I can't seem to finish. It starts nicely enough, but I think I failed to put over my chief idea of their lasting so long and in the end being remarkable only for something they hadn't perhaps meant very seriously. Do let me know what you think of it. I hope you don't find any grammatical solecisms. any secret shagging split infinitives nestling among the inflexible lines. An Arundel tomb. Side by side, their faces blurred, the Earl and Countess lie in stone, their proper habits vaguely shown as jointed armour, stiffened pleat, and that faint hint of the absurd, the little dogs under their feet. Such plainness of the pre-Baroque hardly involves the eye until it meets his left-hand gauntlet, still clasped empty in the other, and one sees, with a sharp, tender shock, his hand withdrawn, holding her hand. 21st of February. Time has transfigured them into untruth. The stone fidelity they hardly meant has come to be their final blazon, and to prove our almost instinct almost true. All that survives of us is love. Comments, please. Spent most of yesterday writhing with indigestion. Cleaned the silver at night. Isn't the snow fearful? 26th of February. Dearest, Coveney showed me Cynthia Asquith's biography of J.M. Barrie, which contains an account of a visit to Hardy. Barrie reported that Hardy had taken him out to show him where he would like to be buried. The next day, he took him out again to show him where he would next like to be buried. According to the account, the only difference was a few inches nearer one wife or the other. This leads naturally onto love being stronger than death. I expect I'm being rather silly, but it is a sentiment that does seem to me only justifiable if love can stop people from dying, which I don't think it can. Love is stronger than death reminds me of that slogan, Britain can take it, which irritated me in the same way. It surely meant that people can stand being bombed as long as they aren't bombed. If A says, we can take it, and B is hit by a bomb, then clearly B can't take it. So A's statement only means A can take B being bombed. Similarly, love is stronger than death means A's love is stronger than B's death, which is self-evident. A's love is not stronger than A's death. Some bright lad said the opposite of love wasn't hate, but individuality. And I've been feeling increasingly that it is this that keeps me from love. I mean, love isn't just something extra. It's a definite acceptance of the fact that you aren't the most important person in the world. 27th of September. My dear, I feel utterly divorced from poetry at present, which I suppose is just a phase. The local snivels through the fields. I sit between felt-hatted mums, whose weekly day excursion yields baby-sized parcels, bags of plums, and bones of gossip good to clack past all the seven stations back. Strange that my own elaborate spree of 14 days should thus run out in torpid rural company, ignoring what my labels shout. Death will be such another thing, all we have done not mattering. This was the parody of myself I wrote. Do you like it? It has an air of the train from Rabbithampton to my ears. The brief summer seems to be over here. Autumn. Autumn. I long to do The Seasons, though I never can write set pieces. It would be my great ambition, like the four quartets. But I know I never shall. 4th of December. Talk about making the sun run. We certainly filled Sunday afternoon well and pleasantly. I liked the pudding and the sauce very much. And that quite remarkable gold turf of cloud filling half the sky when we left. I may let the university magazine have Tomb this Christmas, in which case I'll let you have a copy. I don't myself like it very much. It belongs to that period after publication when one tries to write ideas of poems instead of real poems. In fact, I think it's embarrassingly bad, and I fancy you will too when you see it again. Real poems have more bite to them. Mr. Bleeny is more real. Lamb's is not bad. Better than Tomb. 24th of May, 1957. I've been thinking about Keats rejecting Milton in favour of Shakespeare, and how Yeats and Hardy are the two comparable poles today, and how I, at any rate, reject Yeats. All modern thought and practice is wrong, except the general idea that D.H. Lawrence was a good writer. I wanted to write such a lot, novels particularly, about the way things turn out and the beauty of the natural world, but it doesn't look as if I shall. And I wanted to do it not for my sake, but for its sake. Responsibility is always to the thing, and not to yourself or the filthy reader. I feel the only thing you can do about life is to preserve it, by art if you're an artist, by children if you're not. Otherwise, it flies forgotten, as a dream dies at the opening day. When I think of everything I've seen and felt, and how little of it I've managed to pin, about 3 days of my whole life, then I grind my teeth. 29th of January, 1958. Since getting in, I've read Dacre Balsden's Oxford Life, which, as usual, has left me with a desire to go to the place, for his account bears no resemblance to the 3 shivering, underbred years that the reference books assure me I spent there. The complete absence of dons in my time makes a great contrast. Nor did I get one sniff of the gay, coffee-drinking social life, girls and concerts with recorders. Elgar's daughter, Caris, had a rabbit called Pietro d'Alba, to which he dedicated a part song. Puzzlingly, the name of dedicatee is given as Yvonne in the appendix, and Pietro d'Alba as part librettist. Don't understand this. Perhaps Yvonne was the rabbit's home name. It is difficult to see how it could have helped to write the words. Thursday. Heard Kingsley's programme tonight. Every single record he played, I had taken up to Oxford and introduced him to in 1941. I can quite honestly say I don't think nearly so much of qualities lacking in you as qualities lacking in me. It seems more to me that what we have is a kind of homosexual relation, disguised. Don't you think yourself there's something fishy about it? Perhaps not, or not in that sense. But I sometimes think that what you have isn't a spiritual relation, but a perverse one. It seems to me I am spoiling your life in a hideously ingenious way. I mean, I like you and think you are unique and enjoy being with you, but not in the way commonly associated with girls. I mean, I seem entirely lacking in that desire to impose oneself that is such a feature of masculine behaviour, by marriage, by sexual intercourse, bothering people, inflicting oneself on people. I'm devoid of all that, and it leaves a sort of central, motiveless vacuum. I remember Winifred saying in what was probably exasperation, "I've never met anyone as undemanding as you." I used to cackle at this, but I'm not sure if it really is so funny. 9th of August, Loughborough. I'm sorry that our lovemaking fizzled out in Devon, as you rightly noticed. I felt so tired each night through the relaxing air, and I suppose being on holiday, that the grasshopper became a burden very easily. And, of course, qualify it how I may, I am not a highly sexed person. Or, if I am, it's not in a way that demands constant physical intercourse with other people. My handwriting is awful, unpracticed. I tire very easily, and am always more prepared for sex in the morning than at night. I think sex is a curious thing, a kind of symbol of things we should like to be true and aren't, like being together and losing oneself. That is what always depresses me. The enormous harvest homes you deserve, the few stale, shabby crumbs you get.
tomorrow in the final part. Larkin reaches the age of 50 and reflects on his life. Letters to Monica, read by Hugh Bonneville, abridged by Miranda Davies and produced by Lucy Collingwood. Now, we've wicked relations, talking insects and a giant Prunus persica, which is a peach to you and me, in our classic children's tale starting in next week's 4 o'clock show. When a young boy spills a mysterious concoction near a barren fruit tree, the consequences soon become visible for all to see.
Aunt Sponge and Aunt Spiker began walking slowly round the peach, inspecting it very cautiously from all sides. The massive round fruit towered over them so high that they looked like midgets from another world beside it.
But the fruit's appearance isn't the only amazing aspect of this magical harvest. Miriam Margolyes reads Roald Dahl's James and the Giant Peach, especially for the 4 o'clock show, and it starts on Monday afternoon right here on 4 Extra.
Why on earth do people insist on touching me?
I know how I behaved last night, he said.
Am I supposed to be some sort of unlucky mascot?
But if ever you feel ready to despise me, just remember nobody could despise me more than I do myself.
Radio 4 Extra explores the complex and contradictory life of the broadcaster Gilbert Harding.
I've often thought I'd like to join a monastery.
He could be so thoughtful.
But I should have to behave myself much more than I'm able to do.
And he could be so thoughtless.
The rudest man in Britain. Catch up on the Radio 4 Extra website.
BBC Radio 4 Extra.
3 o'clock and epic drama to come next with me, Wes Butters. And then the writing is on the wall for Mel on today's 4 o'clock show as she explores the history of invisible ink in espionage. She'll also look at the best snacks to chomp on at the cinema, non-rustly ones please, and uncovering the secrets of super sleuth Sherlock Holmes. It should be all elementary. The 4 o'clock show in 1 hour's time. But now we're halfway through the story of the life of Alexander the Great, who, growing up, is already proving himself to be a natural leader. But conspiracy and intrigue are all around, especially when Philip decides to marry again.
Alexander, a six-part serial on the life of Alexander the Great by David Wade. With Michael Maloney as Alexander, Alex Jennings as Hephaestion, Barry Foster as the spirit of Achilles, Simon Ward as the spirit of Patroclus, Brian Cox as King Philip of Macedon, and Geraldine James as Queen Olympias. Alexander, Part 3, Preparation of the Sacrifice. Pella, capital city of Philip, King of Macedon. The year 340 BC.
16 summers now we've kept him company. Alexander, singer who will never sing again.
Boar slayer, horse tamer.
Son of Philip, son of Olympias. Inheritor of a longing that is more than either of them.
Half the span of years which Atropos allotted him is gone.
The flow of time has sculpted him, has brought him to and through the years with Aristotle, changed and yet the same.
Now Philip, king of Macedon, marches east towards Perinthos and Byzantium, while Alexander as his regent rules for him.
Now, we might as well begin with the dispatch from Amphipolis, the gist of which is...
I know the gist, Antipatris. I read it.
When?
This morning.
But I saw you riding with Hephaestion at sunrise.
I was here before dawn. I read all the dispatches.
Have you?
Now, is the information from Amphipolis likely to be correct?
I would say so.
Then we can assume that Athens is recruiting help for Perinthos. The king had better know of it. This one, from the superintendent of mines, Pangaios. I beg the king to believe that without more slaves, the prospect of providing extra bullion is very poor. True or an excuse?
True. The man's a slave driver. If he works his people any harder, he'll kill them. And you'll have to send more anyway.
I'll go and see. Without warning. so keep it to yourself.
When?
Tomorrow. No, later. Tomorrow I want half the Pella garrison out on exercises, the other half the day after.
Simeus!
Alexander! Two, President, correct?
Yes.
Really? Simeus, your men will take part in the exercises.
Yes, Alexander.
In spite of their unsoldierly appearance. They will also take part in tomorrow's and every day on which we train until they cease to come onto parade looking as if they'd spent the night in a Corinthian brothel. Is that clear?
Yes, Alexander.
An energetic day ensues.
Break the line! Come on, forward! Move it, keep together, lads! Come on! Back again! Run! Keep going! Come on, keep together now!
If he leads an army like he runs an exercise, I feel sorry for the person.